This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Christina Eisenberg, lead scientist at Earthwatch Institute. Christina conducts trophic cascades research focusing on wolves and Rocky Mountain ecosystems and has taught ecological restoration and public policy in the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. She has authored multiple peer-reviewed scientific and literary journal articles and is author of the book, The Wolf's Tooth, Keystone Predators, Trophic Cascades, and Biodiversity. Christina Eisenberg is here today to tell us about her most recent book, The Carnivore Way, Coexisting with and Conserving North America's Predators, published in 2014. Welcome, Christina.
It's good to be here.
What is your reason for writing The Carnivore Way?
That's a good question, and that's a question that my editor at Island Press asked me when I was almost done writing my book. And I had an introduction to my book that was very scholarly and where I talked about science and why carnivores matter. But she said to me, Christina, I want you to write me a short piece just for me explaining why you're writing this book and why you've done this work, because I've devoted almost the last 20 years of my life to carnivore conservation, including getting a master's degree and a PhD studying the role of carnivores in ecosystems. So how I got involved in this work and why I wrote this book is because 20 years ago, I lived on a ranch with my family on the Central Coast in California, and the population there quadrupled in a span of about 5 years. And it used to be a very rural area, and we decided we didn't want to raise our kids there. So when my kids were just out of diapers, I have two daughters born 11 months apart, I put them in my Jeep along with the family dog, kissed my husband goodbye, and went on a road trip to find a place where we could settle. And 7,500 miles later, I ended up in Montana in this remote valley that is right up next to the Canadian border. And I called my husband, and he flew out, and he said, this is perfect. And so we've lived in this little log cabin that borders the Bob Marshall Wilderness and Glacier National Park, basically 2.5 million acres of protected federal wilderness. That's my backyard. We thought it was beautiful and very wild, and it is. There were grizzly bears there, but there were no wolves. And about a decade ago, I was gardening at dawn, early morning, with my daughters. There's this big meadow on our land, and that meadow is about 3 acres in size, and we used to watch deer and elk eating in that meadow complacently with their heads down. They were quite tame. So we were gardening that morning, and all of a sudden there's this explosion of sound. Out of the forest burst a deer. And it was running the way I'd never seen a deer run before. Its legs were extended like those of a racehorse. And right behind it were a pair of wolves. And they ran within 20 feet of us. And the deer ran across the meadow into the other side of the forest. And the wolves followed it. And as they passed, one of the wolves turned and looked at me and my daughters. And we were in shock because one doesn't expect to see wolves running across your backyard. But after about 2 minutes, they said, Mom, can we go track them? So we did, and we found that the wolves had left clumps of their hair on a barbed wire fence that bounds our land. I reported it to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they had me start tracking wolves and encouraged me to go to graduate school, the biologists there, to study these effects. Well, within 4 to 5 years, our meadow ceased to exist. There were still lots of deer and elk, but they could no longer afford to stand around complacently eating shrubs and saplings down to ankle height. And now there is a forest where a meadow once was, and the pair of wolves we saw turned out to be the alpha male and female of a new pack that had come down from Canada. And those trees and shrubs provide a home for songbirds we never had on our land before, so they created habitat. So those are the relationships I study. And in the carnivore way, it's not just about wolves. There's 6 species of large carnivores in the North American West. I focused on the West because that is where all the carnivores are concentrated, because that's where all the wild land is, where the wilderness is. If you create a map of carnivore distribution, and we have, my colleagues and I have, and where the wilderness areas are distributed, it coincides with this corridor that I call the carnivore way from Alaska to Mexico. And those six species are lynx, grizzly bear, wolf, cougar, wolverine, and jaguar.
Would you say more about the nature of the land that's in the carnivore way?
It is a patchwork quilt of federally owned state lands and privately owned lands and lands that are part of conservation easements. If you go up north to Alaska, and to write this book, I traveled that whole corridor. It feels infinite, infinitely wild, infinitely untrammeled, but that's really an illusion. There are significant barriers to these carnivores. The large carnivores share very common traits, and one of them is they all need to be able to move. And by move, I mean they often will travel 1,000 miles. And when they become young adults, just like human young adults, they leave home and they start to establish their own territory and find a mate. So all of the large carnivores do that. And because of radio collars, we know that some of them will travel thousands of miles. So threats there include things like busy interstate highways. And there are certain key corridors along the carnivore way as a north to south corridor, but there are corridors east to west that bisect it that are really risky places to be a carnivore. The other thing that's going on is because they disperse like that, these carnivores are coming back to places like the North Cascades, grizzly bears and lynx, and there's wolverines in Washington. There's this wolverine population that is starting to thrive in this state. And all of those animals need to be able to move back and forth freely. So those are some of the issues we're facing today.
Why did you choose the particular six carnivores you chose to talk about in your book?
Because they are species that all of them except for one, the cougar, are federally protected or being considered for federal protection. They are species that we almost drove to extinction, all of them, including the cougar. There's a map made by scientists Andrea LaLiberté and Bill Ripple about a decade ago where, for her doctoral research, she mapped the ranges of all the large carnivores in North America. And a large carnivore is technically defined as any carnivore that weighs more than 100 pounds. 75 pounds, I think, is exactly it. Anyway, she mapped their ranges at the time of the Lewis and Clark expedition using historical records. And then she mapped them again as of 2004. And if you look at the map from 1804, you see that they're well distributed throughout all of North America. It's particularly in the West. When you look at the 2004 map, you see that their ranges have all shrunk northward, and they're mainly all in Canada. Today, if we were to redraw that map, their ranges would come down quite a lot farther south, and we call that the rewilding. But the reason that these animals, their ranges shrank like that, is because humans killed them. That's the primary reason. And the reason that they're coming back is because we're allowing them to come back. And that's a huge shift.
Would you give us a sense of how many of these animals currently exist within the carnivore way?
There are a lot. There's 30,000 grizzly bears, 70,000 wolves. That sounds like a lot, right? If you go to the far north, like the Yukon and Alaska, the Northwest Territories, there's very few people up there, and that's where most of them live. As you go farther south, their densities start to drop pretty sharply. And by the time you get to a latitude that is parallel to, let's say, Seattle, about the southern bounds of most of these carnivores' abundant distribution would be the equivalent of the border between Washington and Oregon, if you drew a line there and extended it east. So that's the threshold. So it sounds like there's a lot of them. Cougars, we don't know how many there are. Certain species like lynx and wolverines have always been lower in number than something like the wolf that has a very high reproductive rate. But there are tens of thousands of these animals.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Christina Eisenberg, author of the book The Carnivore Way, Coexisting with and Conserving North America's Predators. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the benefits of carnivore conservation? Why should we protect carnivores?
Well, I shared with you the story, Diane, about what happened when our backyard got rewilded and how vivid those changes were. And so instead of there being 25 species of songbirds, all of a sudden there were 40 species of songbirds because of the habitat that was created when the elk and deer stopped over-browsing the trees and shrubs. So biodiversity, having a species like a wolf or a grizzly bear present, there has been science done worldwide that shows large carnivores greatly increase biodiversity. And if they're keystone predators, which means a dominant predator in their system, biodiversity, the number, just the raw number of species in an area that contains a keystone predator, can be 90% greater than one that does not. For example, John Terborg did research that demonstrated that with jaguars and harpy eagles in, I believe, Venezuela. So why does this matter? Why do we need all those species? Well, the big looming issue that we're all facing is climate change. And that is what my third book, the one I'm writing now, is about: climate change and wildlife. So a system that contains 100 species of songbirds, we don't really know what specific function each of those species has. But when the climate starts to change, that system will be a lot more resilient to the changes in the climate than one that has 30 species of songbirds or 100 species of plants versus 30 species of plants, because climate change is going to, they're going to be winners and losers and some species that have no effect, but climate change is expected to cause a massive wave of extinction. So if you're already low in number of species, then having carnivores present will boost the biodiversity of a system and will provide a buffer against climate change. And the other thing that carnivores do is they cause energy to cycle more vibrantly through a system. And that's because when they kill something, they don't normally consume all of it because their stomachs aren't big enough. Like a pack of wolves can't eat an entire elk. So that animal ends up feeding the world. It feeds bald eagles, it feeds grizzly bears, it feeds coyotes and ravens. And some of that goes into the ground as nutrients as it decays. And so a system where there's active predation is a lot more vibrant of a system and a lot more resilient than one that does not have that.
Well, you've alluded a bit to this, but what conditions are needed for the carnivores you speak about in your book to thrive?
Well, it's about humans. In fact, I just got back from the Amazon working in the headwaters in the largest tract of intact rainforest. It hasn't been clear cut, but the carnivores were mostly extinct there and they have come back. They've come back because the Kokama Indians there have allowed them to come back. So I was tracking jaguars in a system that has a carrying capacity of 5 large species of carnivores all in one area. And it was amazing. But it was a very powerful lesson about humans. So the reason that we dewilded North America is because of fear. And we did the same thing in Europe in the 16th century, 17th century. In North America, we did this through the 19th and 20th centuries. By about 1910, 1920, most species of large carnivores were extinct in most of their former range. And Aldo Leopold, the famed American conservationist, wrote extensively about this in his book, A Sand County Almanac. So what it comes down to is humans understanding that these carnivores are a lot easier to live with, to coexist with, than we think they are, that they are not really that dangerous to humans. So the fear factor is large. The amount of depredation, killing that they do of livestock is less than what domestic dogs do in every place. And so if we get beyond that fear, that's one of the things it takes. But the main thing that it's going to take is respect. And that means we, and I'll use Washington as an example, but this applies to most states where there are large carnivores and carnivore conservation issues. There's a diverse population that's made up of people that are ranchers and hunters, people that are passionate environmentalists, people that are kind of in between, and people that work for management agencies, both federal and state, and NGOs. And currently, there's quite a lot of divisiveness just about anywhere you look in the West in terms of when the topic of carnivores comes up. Often there are yelling, shouting matches, right? So people are not listening to each other. And what I saw in South America was that it used to be like that, but when people started treating each other with respect and listening to each other's opinions, it's not a black and white issue. And there's a whole spectrum of ways that people respond to these carnivores and a spectrum of solutions that we can find. It's also understanding how critical these carnivores are to having a sustainable future on this planet. And I can't emphasize that enough because of climate change and our growing human population. Figuring out that we can coexist with them, but it has to be not just on our terms, it has to be on the carnivores' terms as well. But coexistence is very possible.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Christina Eisenberg, author of the book The Carnivore Way, Coexisting with and Conserving North America's Predators. In addition to human attitudes, what are the key threats to the carnivore populations in the carnivore way?
Well, the main threat is humans' fragmentation of habitat, and there are two ways that that's happening. One has to do with human infrastructure, like interstate highways or the Trans-Canada Highway. I'll use that as an example, and Snoqualmie Pass, the road that goes through that pass in Washington. So Highway 3 that runs through Banff back in the 70s, they used to call that Blood Alley or the Meat Maker because there was so much roadkill there. And it's the major highway that runs through Canada, and that's a trucking route, and it runs right through a national park. So starting in the 80s and continuing today, the federal Canadian government and the Parks Canada and NGOs have come together and created a series of, I think, about 60 crossing structures, underpasses and overpasses for wildlife on that highway. They built this in four stages over a 25, 30-year period. But what they found is that it's a resounding success. There have been about 300,000 crossings by 19 species. Many of them are species that are extremely at risk, like grizzly bears and wolves and wolverines and lynx. It's a lot safer for people because now collisions with wildlife are virtually non-existent there. And so taking the lessons learned there, here in Washington, Bob Long and Paula McKay have worked to assess the Snoqualmie Pass Corridor. This field of science is called corridor ecology, and it's a really important field. Jody Hilty is another leader in corridor ecology. She's the North American director of the Wildlife Conservation Society. So everybody's put their heads together, and leaders in science, such as Bob Long and Jody Hilty and others, have found solutions. They've gotten ahead of the curve with Snoqualmie Pass because now the region is being recolonized by these large carnivores. And so they have successfully mapped, before the road was widened, where carnivores were crossing. And when the road was widened, put in crossing structures there, and they're being used quite effectively. They're also using non-invasive tools to monitor this, such as camera traps, remote cameras, and track transects. And a variety of NGOs, including groups like Conservation Northwest, have been, it takes a village to do something like this. And so it takes partnerships between agencies, some federal and state, scientists, conservationists, and a lot of citizen science goes into these projects too. So it's very exciting to see that.
How great a role do environmental laws play in carnivore protection?
Huge. I believe that the reason we have any carnivores left in North America, especially in the lower 48 United States, is because of the Endangered Species Act. And NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, that calls for environmental impact statements to be written every time you're going to do anything on public lands, the National Forest Management Act. All of them have very distinct regulations about what is acceptable and policy protocols. However, the ESA is the only law that exists pretty much worldwide, environmental law, that has very distinct prohibitions. It says you can't do this. And in 1973, the law was passed, and one of the first species listed was the gray wolf. And there were no gray wolves left in the lower 48 states except for a tiny population in, I believe, in Minnesota. And now we have thousands and thousands of gray wolves. I mean, they are still at risk for a variety of reasons, but these laws play a huge role. But what's happening today, the ESA is a very expensive law to implement because of all the reports and the checks and the balances. So are the other environmental laws I mentioned. So there is a very active effort underway on the part of Congress to weaken these laws, make them less expensive to apply by making there be less regulations. So the species that I wrote about in my book, all of them have some level of environmental protection or are being considered for environmental protection except for the cougar. And for all of the five species that are protected or being considered for protection since I finished this book 6 months ago, there have been lawsuits proposed and federal actions proposing to completely remove protection of wolves across the United States. Now, what that would do, you know, you can argue that in Montana and Wyoming and Idaho, there's lots of wolves. And we certainly meet the guidelines that were established in the Wolf Recovery Plan back in around 1986. However, what about places like Washington and Oregon, where they're just starting to get a foothold, or Utah or Colorado? So by removing that protection, that leaves those emerging, developing wolf populations quite vulnerable. And that applies to the lynx, that applies to the grizzly bear, it applies to jaguars. So we are right now at a threshold where we're struggling as a nation to figure out how we want to move forward with environmental laws. And one of the big reasons we're going through these struggles is because climate change changes everything.
In your book, you point out that in the carnivore way, you've got three different countries, you have various provinces and states, all of which have their own particular environmental laws. Would you give an example of the governmental jurisdictions animals might pass through when they roam and how their survival might be affected by the route they chose to take?
The species that provides the clearest example would be the grizzly bear. A grizzly bear born in Montana, not far from where I live, would be 100% protected. You can't hunt it. You can't harm a hair on its head unless it is depredating, killing livestock, in which case you still can't harm it, but there are measures that can be taken. So let's say this young grizzly bear, a grizzly bear cub that's born stays with its mom for 3 years, and then mom kicks it out of the nest. And that usually happens when the bear wakes up from hibernation. So you're this three-year-old male grizzly bear, and your mom has just rejected you, and you're dazed and confused. So what this bear does is it goes on a walkabout, you know, looking for a mate and turf, you know, its own place to be, but it's a bit confused. So it starts wandering north from where our home in Montana is. Now, immediately north, we live right due south of the border between British Columbia and Alberta. So if that bear wanders north and decides to go up that Flathead Valley in the North Fork of the Flathead River into Alberta, it's going to run into a lot more mountains, ranching communities, mixed-use communities. However, in Canada, the provincial government protects it completely. So you can't hunt that animal. And so that grizzly bear, that young male bear, has a chance of having a very good life and a long life up there. If, however, the North Fork of the Flathead River, that valley, kind of veers off to the left as you go north as well, and that would take that young bear into British Columbia. There, that bear would have absolutely no protection and can be hunted very aggressively. So these animals, they don't know what these political boundaries are, but their fate is determined by these environmental laws. There's a chart in my book that shows it's like a checkerboard, and some species are totally protected in certain areas, and they cross a line and then forget it. In Canada, we have SARA, which is a Species at Risk Act that's a lot like the Endangered Species Act. But when you go into Mexico, you have the federal wildlife law that sounds great. It's very similar to, let's say, SARA. However, there is no mechanism, no funding to implement it. So it's a law on paper, but in reality, wildlife there, they have a very hard road.
Going forward, what are the best steps to take to coexist with and conserve carnivores?
Well, what we need is to bring everybody to the table, hunters, ranchers, scientists, environmentalists, people who are just plain citizens who don't really know which way to go with this issue. Everybody sit down and talk, build community around the issue and talk with respect. So I am a hunter and I come from a ranching background. My ranching background goes back to the 1700s. And I have spent the last 20 years of my life working to help advance carnivore conservation. I tell you this because we tend to look at things in black and white ways and polarized ways, and those are false dichotomies. And many of us, like me, don't neatly fit into one stereotype. And so there are people who vilify hunters and ranchers, and that is not going to help us reach solutions. I'm not saying that everything hunters and ranchers are doing is ethical or ecologically sustainable, but we're all humans and we all live in this earth household together. So we need to communicate about it in a respectful way. And if we do that, I believe that, like what I observed in the Amazon and what I see where I live in Montana and in portions of Alberta where ranchers are living quite well with grizzly bears on their working ranches, it is very possible to find solutions.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That coexistence is a lot easier than we think it is, and that coexisting with carnivores is essential if we want to have a healthy, sustainable future on this earth.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Christina.
Thank you, Diane.
You were just listening to Christina Eisenberg, author of the book, The Carnivore Way, Coexisting with and Conserving North America's Predators, published in 2014 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at ChristinaEisenberg.com. That's ChristinaEisenberg.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.